You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
From our studio to yours, this is Various Artists.
Ahiahi marie, tēnā koutou katoa, ko mea toka ingoa.
Ko Sophia toku ingoa. No mai, haere mai ki Various Artists mō tēnei wiki. Kia ora, how are you, Mea?
I'm good. You always ask me how I am, but how are you, my lovely?
Oh, I'm good. It's been a busy week, but yeah. Happy to be here.
Yeah, always happy to have you with
best
me.
Best way to end the week. And we have a lovely show today. Mea, what have you got?
Yeah, I had a kōrero with artist Jennifer Mason about her show The Boundary of the Intelligible, which is on at Art Depot Art Space. So what have you got?
I had a kōrero with artist Brett Graham about his show Wastelands, currently on at Auckland Art Gallery.
He aha o whakaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on these pieces. So tuku patsahi mai. You can text us on 5395 rimatoru iwa rima wai mai rane, or give us a call in the studio on 309-3879.
Also, after the show, koa e ware ware e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō hei pakihiri rokiroki maronga i te pai tuku tuku o erirangi poho me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these chats and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Let's get into the show.
Yes, darling, but is it art?
Jennifer Mason is a Tamaki-based oil painter, with a practice centred around Mason's passion for painting the figure, a subject typically known as the nude. Her current exhibition, The Boundary of the Intelligible, delves into new modes of exploration for the artist. In earlier works, Mason typically focused solely on the figure, resembling elements of portraiture with references taken from posed models. But within this new body of work, Mason has shifted her point of reference and has turned directly to the history of Western art and its iconic figures. Recontextualizing these figures from art history and pulling them into her own paintings filled with vibrant prismatic fields of colors, where bodies ascend, weightless and untethered, removed from their past moments and brought into a world of tranquility with renewed vitality separated from space and time. I had a chat with Jennifer about the show and overall practice. Could you start off by introducing yourself and your overall practice a little bit?
Kia ora, I am Jennifer Mason. I was born and raised and live and work in Tamaki Makaurau. I am a traditional classical oil painter who works on canvas.
And is there a kind of underlying theme or investigation that seems to propel your practice?
Yes, I would say, rather than theme, I would say subject. And for me, my subject is what we would say in art history is the nude, which is more of a description. It would just be as to, you know, up to right now, I've painted exclusively the female form without clothes on, which we would call the nude in art history. And that certainly does propel me as a subject. And when you say the word propel, I would probably use the word drive. Like, I have an overwhelming drive in my life to paint that subject, and it's been there for a long time, and I just feel always compelled to keep doing it and keep doing it and keep doing it. Yeah, so that is my drive.
And your current show, The Boundary of the Intelligible, presents a body of beautiful ethereal paintings. These paintings depict figures amongst vibrant prismatic fields of colour. You've already kind of briefly started talking about this, but I would like to start this conversation around this body of work by speaking to the figures themselves. What gravitates you towards the subject of the figure? Like, what kind of gave you this drive to paint these nudes, these figures?
Yeah, it's really hard to say where that seed came from. I guess you would just have to assume that it's nurture over nature. I guess, like, just roughly, as I grew up, I did ballet from age 4 to 16, 6 days a week. Oh. So maybe that was a visual thing that I was taking in on almost a daily basis, that sort of feminine form. So maybe it was just from looking at that a lot. Also, another factor would be that my mother was very, very Catholic. And so in the Catholic faith, there is a very rich culture of paintings. And We didn't really have much art in the home, but what we did have is once a year we would get this Catholic calendar and it would, you know, like one of those sort of things you'd hang on the wall, a paper one, and you flip over the pages and there would be like a Renaissance painting. And and I got that because I liked art and pictures and my mother would give me that. So that would go on my wall and each, you know, month would flip by and I would really love those and I would copy them. And so that would, you know, and then you'd be in church and you'd see paintings in church and... So that was probably an influence as well. And then when the maybe the other thing that started it was that after high school, I went to become a nurse and did a nursing degree. And I loved the academic side, like the anatomy and I am not a nurse. That was a disaster career if there ever has been one.
Oh,
but
no.
Yeah, but certainly the theoretical part of it and the anatomy, so maybe... That was it. But I remember going to a show called Angels and Aristocrats, and I must have been in my early 20s at the Auckland City Art Gallery. It was by Mary Kisler. And I went with my brother and mother, and they were just viewing that exhibition, you know, with mild interest, I suppose. And I remember I was running around.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and I was just like, I love this. This is so exciting. I love these paintings, you know, like... It was, I guess you'd say, a bit of an epiphany of just like, I just love these. And, you know, I had that thing in my head where it was like, I mean, I was happy to look, but there was something inside of me that said, I'd love to be able to do that.
Yeah.
I would love to be able to do that. Since then, I didn't do art at high school, but I was, you know, copying classical paintings in my bedroom.
Oh, wow. So you were always kind of mulling away at
just
them.
Just doing them pretty poorly, And it's just something that's stuck with me. And now I can't sort of stop, and it's an obsession now,
And in earlier works, your depiction of the figure came from professional models and acquaintances, but within this body of work, you have shifted your focus to the rich history of the Western art canon and its iconic figures. What influenced this shift in reference for you?
I think when it comes to my practice, what I have is a vision of the painting I would like to paint. And it's sort of, I haven't got it as a picture in my mind as such, but I kind of know what I want to do. And I have spent my whole life trying to make that painting and trying. Yeah. So as I've gone along trying to reach that vision, I encounter problems along the way and then I try and fix that problem. But I'm always going in a trajectory along trying to achieve my vision. And so when I saw those paintings in the art gallery, I thought, oh, okay, well, what did they do? They hired a model and they posed the model and they painted the model. So I thought, that's what I'll do and I'll achieve the same results.
Yeah.
And what I discovered, and this is the biggest blind spot I've had as an artist, and it blows my mind that I have missed this. So what happened is that I was, first of all, just asking females that I knew, I guess you'd say acquaintances, to come in, and I would take, like a photo shoot, and then I would do the paintings. And then what I noticed other people would come and look at the works, and what would happen is they would nitpick the subject. They'd find something on, like about the body or the face or there's something else about them, and they would say, the first thing that they would say is that thing about, and I just thought, that's not my vision. So there was that aspect, and there was also another aspect where people would sometimes say things, and it's amazing how it never really sunk in for me, but they would say things like, oh, you're painting naked ladies. And I would just think, what on earth is wrong? I just would think, what's wrong with you? I had a studio. I hired a studio out at Corbin's Art Centre in West Auckland. And we had these open days and it was open to the general public. So this lady came into the studio and she was looking around my work and she said, oh, I really love these paintings. I love these. Mm. And then she said, my husband would hate these. And I thought, okay, this is good. I said, why is that? And she said, because they're naked, he associates it with sex and he's funny about sex. Mm. And it was just this penny drop moment where, I had been painting figures from art history in my mind, and other people were coming in and looking at my paintings, A, as a portrait, and B, as a naked lady, and bringing all their junk into my paintings. And it was just, like, it was, I couldn't believe I'd been doing it for so long and not realised that that's what people were seeing. And because I had never, I mean, when I walked around that art gallery and saw those paintings, I didn't really see naked people, you know, I didn't see naked people, and I wasn't thinking about them in a sexual context. So that blew my mind. And so I thought, that's a problem. And I thought, how can I take that component out while still painting the figure, which is what I want to do? And so what I did is, the first thing I tried to do was I posed the model in a way where I thought I could disguise her while still having her there. So things like, one pose I got really stuck on is a prone pose, which is her lying down, face down, you shoot from the side so you're not, you know, it's not frontal, and then I would get her to place her arm over her face, which takes away the portraiture element. But even then, people would still see that thing that I had a problem with. And that wasn't what I was trying to do. You know, it's not like a Lucian Freud work where it's a portrait of someone and he's really showing flesh and he's really showing a naked body. I was trying, my vision was something quite different. And so I thought, how can I get a body where it takes away from that completely? And that's where I just had that idea of, can I just pull these figures out of this art historical context and use them and find a way to make them mine, to detach my figures from any of that stuff, any of that misreading that people were picking up on. And that's what made me say, well, let's try it. Let's pull some of these figures out and work with them and see if I still get that same reading coming in, or if I can work closer to my vision, which I'm trying to achieve.
Yeah, and how do you think it has shifted your work?
Well, it's early days. I mean, this is just a recent development. I mean, I'm always, you know, like, when I tried the different pose and I tried to, that didn't work. People were still having that same reading. So just, it has been quite recent, but I mean, you're always hopeful when you think you've solved a problem. But I think when you do pull them out of art history, a lot of that stuff drains out. So I'm hoping this can be a way for me to still paint the figure without those problems arising. My vision is that I want a body, I want to paint the figure, but I want it to be, number one, weightless. So if you think of a William Bouguereau painting where those female bodies and the little Cupid angels are just flying off, or Christ ascending, where people are just floating off into the atmosphere like gravity suddenly disappeared. I want that's something I would like. And I also would like, I still want to see the beautiful form around limbs and have that done well, but I want my edges to be so soft and the atoms at the edge of the body to be, as they're lifting off and lifting away, I want those atoms to just be drifting off either into water or to the air, to just become, like a human body is quite a heavy thing. I want to take all that away, and I want it to be weightless and like it could just puff off into smoke. Yeah, so that's the goal.
Yeah.
That's the goal.
Oh, beautiful. And within this new body of work, you have also shifted your composition. Rather than solely focusing in on the figure, you have almost stretched out the composition and allowed more space for that feel to enter into the work. Could you speak a bit to this decision of these vibrant prismatic fields of colour that you've introduced to your work?
Sure. Well, when I saw those paintings in the gallery, I thought, you know, I never ever considered that I had any talent or skill out of, you know, everyone. I just thought, I can't do it. I don't know how to do it. I can't do it. And I just thought, I'm going to have a crack at it. I'm going to do the 10,000 hours, you know, that they say it takes to become good at something.
Wow, yeah.
And I am just going to sit down and keep going over and over and over until I can paint you know, a face and a body that I could, you know, I really feel like could come alive off the page.
Mm.
And so that took me a long time. And I ignored the backgrounds. I ignored the edges of the painting. And I just kept going on the figure over and over and over. And then I did reach that point where I was like, that's really realistic. That's realistic. We've achieved realism.
Yeah.
I did it.
Yeah, you did it. They're so beautiful, rendered. Yeah.
Thank you. And but then, of course, once I got to that point, it's like, all right, well, I've ignored my edges. I've ignored my backgrounds. We need to go back to stage one and play some catch up here. And as I explained to you that I wanted these figures to be weightless, lifting off without gravity, I just thought the background is a great way. I mean, obviously the pose of the individual, but the background has to be as light and as airy as I want that figure to be. So one of the biggest things that has happened to me recently is that I started working wet into wet as a painter. And prior to that, I was terrified of my inability to be able to paint. And I would work from the top left-hand corner and I would work down towards the bottom right-hand corner, sort of across and down, millimetre by millimetre. And once I reached the bottom, I would let it dry and then I would go over, I'd do seven coats over like that. So, yeah. And then I'd let it dry and then I'd go over and working, you know, eventually working to a glaze finish.
Yeah, it's a very meticulous, detailed.
Precisely, yeah. But that gets you a hard edge. I had a very hard edge. It was like a sticker. You could peel that thing off the board. So when you work wet into wet, you've got your background wet, you've got your figure wet, and it's a race against time. That paint's drying and boom, my edges were blurry. You know, I mean, I could spend 4 hours getting the edge of a face and the edge of an arm and a bit of a background, and then I can get my blendy brush and I can just sweep over it, you know, and get rid of a lot of the sharpness. And suddenly my edges were just so soft and light and delicate.
Beautiful.
Yeah, but it takes a lot of guts to go wet into wet.
Yeah.
You know, you have to be confident that you can render something up. You have to make sure you've got that time.
Yeah, there's a lot more like fluidity in the paint and a lot of more elements for things not, you don't have as much control.
Zero control. And you need to be confident of your ability. And I hadn't had that confidence up to that point. Yeah.
I see. And you've spoken about this art history and your time in that gallery when you saw these works. Now with this new kind of process of working wet into wet and these beautiful coloured fields, how do these fields aid in this recontextualization of these figures from art history?
That's a great question, yeah. Well, I just thought it would be so great to be, I mean, I have a whole library of, I go through art history, I pull out all these images, I'm building up this library, I use Photoshop quite a bit, I move all the different figures around completely out of their context, and then I think about light coming in, and I really am thinking about, so you have a big bunch of colour down the bottom, and there's a figure just above it, sort of, and you know, like she's aware of that colour, and you can just sweep around with brushes, and next thing you know, it's almost like the canvas is pulling her around. And another aspect in terms of colour, I mean, I've just started backgrounds, I've really just started colour. I'm stage one. I've got a lot of catching up to do. But I did find that, because I had, up to this point, I had been painting all my nude skin colour, and I had that down to a very fine art. And I went out to the shop and bought a bunch of colour. And I just thought, if you make a figure blue, you do take a lot of that nudity out of that form.
Mm.
There's something about the colour of skin. People find that quite evocative. So I have started painting my figures, you know, like we start in a cerulean blue and we move up and we change around to greens. And so the colours in the backgrounds have blended over into the form.
Mm.
Yeah, and I also am pretty influenced by the Impressionists. There was a show, a Monet show, came to Auckland. I think it was about 1986. And I went with my grandfather and mother, and at the time I really didn't see what the big deal was. But since then, I've just become the biggest Monet fan in terms of colour.
Yeah.
And, I'm always I'm buying those old catalogues off, or, you know, the books off Trade Me. I'm pulling out the pages, sticking them around, trying to think about the way he used colour, and can I bring his colour theory into my figures to bring all that light, what he would do with light, into the figures, just to pull away from, you know, the idea of nudity or nakedness more and more.
Yeah. And lastly, what are your hopes for viewers as they enter into the space of your show and engage with your work?
Sure. Well, a little bit like how we were talking earlier, that I hope that if it's maybe someone that knows my practice, that I would hope that they could see what I'm doing. They'd be like, oh, okay, she's solved that problem. She's moving towards this. Like, I hope that it makes sense to people, that they can see, oh, she's going there. That's the direction that she's trying hard to push towards. That's what she's trying to achieve. Mm. That it wouldn't just seem like a bunch of random stuff. Because I'm certainly never painting the same thing more than once. I'm always trying to push the practice. But in terms of if someone was coming in and they didn't know me and they were coming in fresh,
yeah.
I think in your email you used the word ethereal. I do love it when people use that, because that's spot on. I really like paintings of fairies. I love things that are very light and delicate and soft and calm. And I want people to feel very at ease. I don't want them to feel shocked. I want beauty to come out of them and just to feel calm, I guess. Yeah, that would be my hope, that people would just, they wouldn't feel any stress and it would just feel light and airy.
That was Jennifer Mason speaking to me about her current show, The Boundary of the Intelligible, which is on at Depot Art Space until the 13th of September.
Only positive critiques. Honest.
Various artists.
We've now got one of my favourites. This is Julia Wears a Cross by Julia Jacklin. Enjoy.
Closed, I felt pretty. In the shoes and the dress, confused by the rest, couldn't hear me. Lydia wears a cross, says she's never gonna take it off. We sit back to back, listening to Jesus Christ, Superstar soundtrack. Be a believer if it was all just song and dance. I'd be a believer if I thought we had a chance. Eyes to the board, thoughts to our Lord, we were praying for Princess Diana. A child in a leotard beneath a technicolor dream coat. I'd be a believer if it was all just song and dance. I'd be a believer if I thought we had a chance. Thank you.
BFM.
Make a mess and gear up to make some noise with Squish Bang Splat at MOTAT.
A day of hands-on fun with creative design challenges, art experiments, and percussion fun with drums. Plus, live science shows with the Little Scientist team and so much more.
Squish Bang Splat at MOTAT, Saturday 6th and Sunday 7th of September.
Included in general admission. Find out more at motat.nz.
One of Aotearoa's most beloved artists, Bic Runga, is set to deliver an exceptional evening of music and song, Saturday, September 6th. Catch Bic performing songs from her bountiful catalogue, reinterpreted for orchestra and presented together with the majestic Auckland Philharmonia. Don't miss the inimitable Bic Runga, live for one night only with the Auckland Phil, Saturday, September 6th at the Aotea Centre. Tickets available now from aucklandphil.nz.
Heavy, psychedelic, synth-driven trio Half Hexagon are releasing their first two EPs on vinyl. EP1 and EP2 join forces on one limited edition record. Plus, the album will feature an additional 2 exclusive unreleased bonus tracks. EP1 and EP2 by Half Hexagon. Available on vinyl now where fine music is sold.
Future sounds from the underground. The hottest new tracks from Aotearoa and around the world.
Totally wired.
Sounds from up to 2 weeks in the future. Next month, even.
Some of these tracks are like 2026 vibes, bruv.
A great amount of energy.
Totally Wired with Hunter. Tomorrow's music today, 11 a.m. till 2 p.m. Only on 95 BFM. Thanks to Flying Out. Flyingout.co.nz.
West Coast, chopping.
Regan, wake
East
up.
West Coast.
Honey, you're having those strange nightmares. Oh, no, it's not.
1 out of 10 on both coasts.
Oh, God. Father Damien, it's happening again.
Looking for tubular swells? It's the 95 BFM Surf Report. Is the West Coast gnarly? Is the East Coast bogus? Do people even still use these words? Find out every morning on breakfast and every afternoon on drive. The Totally Radical Surf Report, proudly brought to you by the dudes and dudettes at ProGear.
What's it all for?
Various artists.
Wastelands is an exhibition by Brett Graham, Ngāti Koroki Kahukura Tainui, currently on at Auckland Art Gallery Toyo Tamaki. The exhibition is presenting one of Graham's most powerful sculptural works, Wastelands, commissioned as a response to works of his father Fred Graham's in the 1970s for the 60th Venice Biennale in 2024, alongside a new video work, Whangamārino, a panorama of footage documenting a fire raging across the Whangamārino wetlands, which shares the same locational subject as the sculptural work it displays itself with. The works address the rich history of this area and resulting degradation, continuing an interest in Graham's practice and the impact of Pākehā settlement and colonisation on tangata whenua and Te Taiao, where Waikato Tainui lands were once abundant in resources and other taonga. The wetlands were confiscated by colonial government following the 1863-64 Waikato War through the Wastelands Act 1858 and New Zealand Settlements Act 1863 and sold as pasture. Being the first time Wastelands has been exhibited in Aotearoa, the exhibition shows Graham bringing to life his vision for installation, inviting the viewer into a powerful, ominous and almost haunting environment. I had a kōrero with Brett Graham about the making of Wastelands.
Kia ora, my name is Brett Graham. I'm a sculptor and most of my work is about looking at Indigenous issues and colonisation and its effects. I'm working for about 30 years. I was a lecturer at Elam and a student there as well, so I'm very familiar with Auckland University. I do have a preference for wood and I come from a carving background, but that doesn't limit me to use stone or all sorts of contemporary materials as well. So that's why the work Wastelands has a sculpture, large wooden sculpture, as well as a video work.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit more in depth about the Wastelands work. Your current show at Auckland Art Gallery, Toyo Tamaki, presents a powerful sculptural work of yours, Wastelands, which was created for the 60th Venice Biennale last year. This is the first time it's being exhibited in Aotearoa. How does it feel for you to have it back home?
Oh, it's very exciting to have it here. It's, as you say, it was in the Arsenale, and that was exciting because basically in the corridor it was in the whole art world go down and pass that work in the Arsenale. So, but I had no sort of control over where the work was and the space it was in. Whereas here at the Auckland Art Gallery, I could sort of create the environment that I wanted for that work. So that's the exciting thing, to see it realised as I'd imagined.
The work was produced and commissioned as a response to works of your father, Fred Graham's, in the 1970s. Could you speak a little as to your initial thought process in responding to his work? How did you approach this?
Well, the curator of the Biennale is named Adriano Pedrosa from Brazil, and he's interested in sort of telling stories that hadn't been told before or and giving minority voices. And So the scene was strangers everywhere, and so among that, you know, he was talking about Indigenous people that had been marginalised, and of course, Māori don't see themselves as strangers in their own land, but sort of created a platform in that kind of art environment to talk about Indigenous issues. And actually, the space I was in was quite cool. There was work by a well-known Aboriginal artist and Native American artist, and he'd included Sandy Adsett and Selwyn Wilson and my father's work, as well as my Taho and myself, because he was quite intrigued by the fact that Indigenous artists had been, or Māori artists had been engaged with Western art from, well, basically ever since Europeans Pākehā arrived in Aotearoa, but certainly that movement that professed to sort of look at Western modernism and sort of combine that with elements in the culture from Māori art. So, yeah, it was great that he allowed me to sort of make responses to Dad's work. And these are all things I've grown up with, family home, and I was excited to see them in that context on this world stage.
This work in reinterpreting a carved pātaka with carved eels twisting and turning over each other within it, wagon wheels to mobilise it, and these outreaching arms as handles is continuing an interest in your practice in creating these hybrid traditional forms. What is it that interests you about these hybrid forms, and how are they employed to communicate these driving ideas in your practice?
Well, it's interesting that you call them hybrid forms because, you know, most art is a hybrid of one or another. It's, you know, it's usually a combination of a few ideas to make hopefully something that's new or innovative. But yeah, my father is Māori and my mother was Pākehā. So those ideas of cultural crossovers sort of have always intrigued me. And in a lot of ways, the most dynamic sort of culture is created by that kind of tension between Māori and Pākehā in the country. And then, of course, much later, multiculturalism that has emerged. And all of those connections give us a much richer culture. So, yeah, I've always been fascinated in that period of around about the 1870s when the Māori and Pākehā population were roughly equal and the dynamic culture that emerged from there. So, you know, the idea of putting a pātaka, which used to be the way that tribes expressed who they were, and used to be the most prestigious kind of building before the wharenui. So the idea of putting it on wheels and making a statement of impermanence kind of intrigued me. And also referring to all of the turbulence of that time when a lot of Māori groups were supposed to were forced into migrating because of Raupatu confiscations and the other events of those times.
In exploring the relationship between Waikato Tainui peoples to the Waikato River, Tupuna and surrounding wetlands in Taonga, each element of wastelands is very symbolic. Are you able to talk us through each of these elements, the pātaka as the base of the work, as well as the carved eels, wagon wheels and arms? What do you see each element to represent?
Well, as you say, Adriano invited me to make a work that responded to my father's. And at first I thought of making something that kind of looked like my father's because I was so familiar with his style. But then I thought, you know, it's obviously, that's one way of doing it. But then I thought I would actually make a work that responded to all of the ideas that he was showing in his work. And so he was talking about legends of Tinero. And also one of the works is about Tangaroa, the god of the sea. So his works are really exploring the way Indigenous people respond to nature and those pūrākau, as we'd say, those sort of fundamental stories about that give us clues as to how we respond to nature. And yeah, so that was the starting point, and sort of bringing it forward to 2024 when I made the work, looking at how different those points of view were between sort of Indigenous ideas of the whenua of the land and the sort of extractive risk culture that was brought by settlers from Europe. And of course, things that were prized and valued like tuna, like the eel, and food sources associated with wetlands disappeared or were not as valued as much as sheep and cows and the dairy industry that's so dominant now, hence the yields in that work as a response to that. And also the fascination for wetlands. A lot of the land in the Waikato was drained. And it's always intrigued me that whenever you pick up a settler account of the land, it always starts off of the history here. The first sentence is always, oh, when we arrived here, there was nothing but swamp. But of course, that's not true. Those swamps are actually precious because of their resources. Yeah, so I wanted to talk about that culture of extractivism and how it's led to climate change.
Wastelands does seem to embody quite similar qualities to your work, Maungarongo Ki Te Whenua, in your Tai Moana Tai Tangata series. How do you see the two works interrelate, or where do you see wastelands sitting in your wider practice?
The overall theme of Tai Moana Tai Tangata was very much, as well as looking at that relationship between Waikato and Taranaki, it was very much about a critique of that settler extractivism. So in that way, the works are similar. But in the case of the work, which is also a wagon, so formally it sort of is similar. But in that case, that work was sort of a homage to the Taranaki leaders and their strategies for advancing their people, like it, for example, Te Whiti and Tohu at Pariaka, and also Te Tohu Waru. So it does look very much in form like Maungarongo, but the ideas are quite different.
For sure. In terms of physical process, what goes into making a sculptural work like Wastelands?
Well, actually, it was interesting because we didn't have a lot of time. We had the whole work had to be on a ship to Venice in 8 months. So we, I worked with a team of people who are carpenters and there's another carver I work with. So there's always people involved and there's a frame that's been built. I made a wax model. It was scanned by a talented friend and then we knew how much wood was needed and then the whole thing, this laminated timber over a metal frame and then shape carved. A lot of work for 8 months and a lot of people involved, not just me.
For sure. That is a tight time frame, so I imagine that would have been a lot. This sculptural work is, of course, paired with the new video work, Whangamārino, which shows this almost panorama of footage of a fire raging across the Whangamārino wetlands, the same area which Wastelands refers to. Tell me a bit more about this work, and I guess you've kind of answered it a little bit throughout your answers, but what about the history of this area made it feel important or necessary to create this work specifically?
Well, as you say, it was talking about the same wetland and Waikato. And while I was, just the start of last year, the Whangamārino, which is like the kowhata, the wetland there, actually caught on fire. And it created a stunning sort of visual image of the fire in a line sort of advancing across over the plain, and so it's this beautiful, strong image. But it's also connected to the idea that I was intrigued with it in Waikato, that a lot of the land, the bush and the wetlands had been drained in the 1870s, 80s, and then turned into farmland that we sort of take for granted now, this rich Waikato farmland. But whole areas like the Hauraki Plains had been drained or they'd been forested and then drained in that way. But always intrigued with peat swamps, because they're 3% of the Earth's surface, but they retain 40% of the world's carbon. So apparently it used to be quite a common sight in the 50s and 60s when these peat swamps would be drained or burnt, and you'd see the smoke, and they keep on burning because it's the debris from forests. Centuries-old forests that gather, and so when Whangamārino caught fire, I thought it would be appropriate to use with Wastelands because it expressed a lot of those ideas about how the land was transformed.
And you kind of signaled at it much earlier in our kōrero today that installing this work in Aotearoa has allowed you to have a lot more say in the way it's being presented. And the installation of this exhibition is so deeply powerful. The scale of the sculptural work paired with the dark lighting and liquidesce black flooring and the crackling soundscape of the accompanying video work creates this kind of ominous and commanding space which the viewer is drawn into. Are you able to speak a little on... Yeah, of course. Are you able to speak a little on the installation process and vision for this?
As I say, there's books that I've loved, like Uruora by Jeff Parks, for example, that sort of express a lot of these ideas. But yeah, no, I was lucky to be able to exhibit it in that room. And then the floor is this beautiful reflective surface. I was also intrigued by the idea when people came from Europe and landed here, they had sort of a deep fear of first the forest, the Ngahere, which of course Māori used to retreat into as refuge when they were under attack, but also of the swamps and the wetlands. And there's sort of this phobia also of black water. And so that's what I wanted to give the impression of, that this was almost floating above the water and creating those beautiful reflections, the ripple effect. And of course the film also is reflected in the fire is also reflected in that, the shiny black surface. A lot of video installations, of course, they'll use this because they like reflections, but I wanted to do it in regards to the sculpture and create that sort of depth of the black water.
Mm, it's truly such an amazing space to walk into. I had a bit of like a physical reaction walking into it because it just really does have so much power in it, as I said. For people who do enter into this space, how do you hope that they engage with this show and these works?
Well, I love the sensory, in fact, that, you know, engages the sound, the visual force of the fire. People are always intrigued by fire. And then walking around the work, of course, because it's very tactile. So, yeah, I love sculpture and the power of touch and tactile surfaces. And then, of course, being so large, it sort of creates another emotive power. So, hopefully they engage with the fact that, you know, they can engage all of those senses when they walk in. The power of those things together hopefully creates a rich experience for people. And then, you know, I'm a firm believer that if people are engaged in the work, well, then they'll come to the ideas after that. And, but, you know, the hook is the visual sensation. And then...
That was Brett Graham speaking to me about his show Wastelands, currently on at Auckland Art Gallery Toyo Tāmaki. You can catch the exhibition on the gallery's ground floor in the Taimoana Coastlines Art in Aotearoa exhibition until the 15th of February 2026.
Various artists, so you can go to the opening for more than just the snacks.
We'll be right back to give you your arts guide very shortly. In the meantime, this is Jessica Pratt.
Thank you. I'm on it, you're in it, I'm on earth. It's the 95 BFM Art Guide on various artists. It's paintings in that.
This week in the wonderful world of art in Tamaki Makaurau. As mentioned on the show, Jennifer Mason's The Boundary of the Intelligible is on at Depot Art Space until the 13th of September.
Also, as mentioned on the show, Brett Graham's Wastelands is on at Auckland Art Gallery Toyo Tamaki on the gallery's ground floor in the Tai Moana Coastlines Art in Aotearoa exhibition until the 15th of February 2026.
Kathy Barry's We Went to the Edges of Time is on at Melanie Roger Gallery until the 6th of September.
So Connor, an exhibition by Jana Dombrowski and Bai, is on at Grace Gallery until the 13th of September.
And this is the last day to view paintings by Seraphine Pick on at Michaelette Gallery.
The Tongue to Them is still on at Artspace Aotearoa on Karangahape Road until the 4th of October.
Icon by Maggie Friedman and Amon Nakuru is on at Coastal Signs until the 13th of September.
And this weekend is the last weekend to catch Peter Robinson and Giorgio Griffa's dialogue exhibition Differences in Kind and Rhythm on at Te Uru until the 24th of August. If you have something you want on the Art Guide, you can email us at art@95bfm.com.
That was the 95BFM Art Guide.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi kia koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā.
That's all for us on various artists for today. Nā mihi nui to everyone who spoke with us today.
Brett Graham.
Jennifer Mason.
Nei rā hoki te mihi kia koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in.
And remember, you can listen back to all of today's pieces on 95bfm.com.
Ka hoki mai mātou a tērā wiki. Next up is The Land of the Good Groove with Nigel. My name is Sophia.
I'm Maya.
And that was various artists.
We'll catch you next week.
You're listening to 95BFM. Ka kite.
Ka kite.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.